Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode number 29. I'm Rob Wright, editor of Search Security, and I'm here with Peter Loschen, my site editor. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Rob.
Peter, we got a lot to talk about. Actually, I guess we don't have a lot to talk about because you did most of the talking. This is a special episode of the Risk and Repeat podcast. It is an interview that, Peter, you did recently earlier this month at Rapid7's 2016 United Customer Conference. You had a very interesting conversation that we're about to hear on the podcast with a couple folks from Rapid7.
Yes, it was great. I had a chance to talk to Todd Beardsley, who is Senior Security Research Manager at Rapid7, and Rebecca Brown, who is Threat Intelligence Lead there. And they had a lot of really good things to say. So I didn't really do that much talking either.
No, I guess that's true. I would say the interview covered a variety of topics, including the role of security analytics. I think that's actually the first question. Vulnerability disclosure and how that's handled. Some other elements as well. But the big sort of topic of discussion was around IoT security, IoT threats. What are we doing about the Internet of Things? And it's a very timely conversation because Rapid7 actually introduced at the conference a new security practice devoted to IoT security that I think is specialized around transportation IoT, but covers a variety of IoT uses and technologies, not just the devices themselves, but also the associated applications, APIs, embedded hardware, firmware, et cetera, et cetera. So interesting conversation there, and certainly the transportation angle comes up in the discussion. Rebecca Brown has an interesting little anecdote about her experience with internet-connected cars that I think is interesting. And it's a fun conversation. The pen testing stories and incident response stories, their experiences there are pretty fascinating. So, Peter, thank you so much for doing that interview with them and for attending the show.
It was fun.
Yeah. We got a lot of information out of it, which was great. So let's take a listen to Peter's interview with Todd Beardsley and Rebecca Brown of Rapid7.
First question, let's start with this one. Has security analytics technology effectively replaced SIM and log monitoring products?
So I personally do not think it has, because the data you need to actually do those security analytics has to come from somewhere. And so if you don't have something in place to gather that data, you're not going to be able to find any analytics that are going to make any sense. Especially if you want to look back. A lot of times, you can do real-time monitoring, real-time trending, and that will give you some good data. But there are times when you're going to want to look back and be able to look at things that right now I might not know to look for, but something might happen next week, and right. I say, oh my goodness, I need to get more data on that, and I need to have that somewhere.
Yeah, and ultimately, it's like the 538 polling, right? Like, Nate Silver would be out of a job if he put everyone else out of a job. And so I don't think that, you should be retiring your collectors really anytime soon. And ultimately, too, with all the security data analytics, like, you need people, right, to be looking at that. And so, like, on the other side of the equation, not only do you have all your collectors and aggregators and log monitors and all those things, and you have your analytics suite, but you have all the people, too, that need to make sense of it, right? We automate it as much as we can. We have tons of, like, machine learning in there and adaptive algorithms and all the cool, like, buzzwordy things. But at the end of it, you need, like, a person who's able to act, so they're not getting drowned in everything, and be and willing to act and confident enough to act. And so that's kind of where we're trying to get these people who are the technology professionals in that position where they can act deliberately and they can make decisions quickly in both the real-time scenario and in the historical scenario.
So another question that came from the peanut gallery. This is a big one. Give us your thoughts on Mirai and the other, you know, similar kind of IoT activity that we're seeing so much of recently,
Do you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start.
Topic?
Yeah, so Mirai is, it's definitely a wake-up call, right? A lot for many years. You know, we've been looking at IoT through the lens of that is too easy. It's junk hacking. It's stunt hacking. You know, it's hacking on easy mode. Like we, the security industry is tended to be pretty dismissive of IoT. And I think the Mirai event, bummer for Dyn DNS, but not so bad for everyone else, because it really illustrates like, no, this is real and this is serious. And we've been seeing this coming for a while, right? Like 2016 is really where like IoT kind of came out of the ghetto, the security research ghetto anyway, for both like attackers and defenders, right? Like we're all taking a look at this in a much more serious way now, because I think the thing that the Mirai botnet illustrated is twofold, right? One, it shows that not only do we have to defend like these IoT devices and make sure that they're built securely so your personal data doesn't get leaked and your camera's not on the internet, but we have to get it to a point where we're able to defend against it, right? So not only security on IoT is not only securing the device and securing your stuff, but it's securing everyone else too, right? So there's kind of a there's a social good there that needs to be done. And secondly, it didn't really matter, the video part of it. Like most of these things are like DVRs, CCTV, stuff, things like that. That particular data didn't matter at all, right? It's not what the attacker was going for. The attacker was going for CPU, a little bit of storage, and a little bit of bandwidth, you know, multiplied many times. And so I think that Mirai really will help kind of wake up not just the security industry to like, no, this is serious. This is not just joking around and stunt hacking. But wake up, you know, every manufacturer there that makes an internet-connected device, which is actually every manufacturer.
Yeah, I know the biggest thing, you know, the whole issue with default passwords or hard-coded passwords, we're seeing that in other devices as well. We've known about it for years and years,
yep.
And everyone says, oh, well, but nobody's going to do that, and no one's going to use it. And so this is a very clear example of, yes, they actually do. The attackers know about all the flaws you know about. You can't keep anything a secret, or you can't hope that they don't know about it. And it also, you raise a very interesting point where they didn't care about the data. They didn't care about the stuff on there. But that doesn't mean they won't in the future.
Right.
It doesn't mean now that they say, oh, okay, well, here's one way we can use this. Well, you know, what's to say that they won't come up with a more creative way now that they're very comfortable in
right.
the let's hack all the IoT stuff space. So.
Right, and it's like it's that kind of shift in thinking that like we saw with ransomware last
exactly.
year, right? Where attacker doesn't super care about the data. They care that the data's there and that it's something
they
to
care,
encrypt.
Yeah, they care that somebody will pay.
Right, but
pay
really,
yeah.
I'm not going to steal all your grandkids' pictures and sell them on the internet. Like that's not very viable. It's much more viable to just ask them for money directly.
Yep.
So instead of saving this one for the end, I thought we'd throw this one in the middle. Have you got any good pen testing horror stories? What are the craziest, most unbelievable things you found during tests? And you don't have to give names, so the guilty can remain unmarked.
Does
it have to be a pet? So I... I've been doing a lot more of the incident response lately. Is it so?
Sure. Yeah, that'll work.
So this was, before I was with Rapid7, I was working in the state and local government space, and they have no resources and no funding and no staffing. So it was a very difficult job. So they would come to me when they had problems, and I would help out as much as I could. And there was one time there was a city, and their city hall had they had gotten something through their logs. They thought, okay, something's wrong with their networks. Give me all your stuff. We looked into it and realized two of their domain controllers were just completely riddled with malware. And these are domain controllers that basically can touch everything else in the entire city. I mean, all of their infrastructure was connected. And so we told them, oh my gosh, this is bad. You don't even have data past 6 months. We can see at least it's been back 6 months, and so we're good. And so kind of came up with a plan how we could help them. And their sysadmin was like, no, it's okay. I wiped the boxes, so we're good. And I'm like, you wiped them? He's like, yeah. You know, I only had been allocated 2 hours to solve this problem, so I just wiped them, and I got to go work on my other stuff. And I was like, all right, I'll see you next week then, I guess, because it's very clearly not solved. But that was the way they approached the problem. This was only a few years ago. This was not 20 years ago.
Yeah. You know, and I think that illustrates that there remains a gap between, like, IT people and security people. And so we're hopeful that we can start bridging that gap, like, a lot more seriously. A lot of people talk about it. We're actually trying to do it.
Yes.
You know, with our Insight platform, like, makes things... It's not merely, like, make things easy, but at least make the easy things easy so you have time for, like, the hard and, you know, kind of fun stuff. You know, I got started in security from IT. You know, kids these days, they go and they get their cyber degree and they are, like, instantly into security, and they have a background in, like, the realities of change control review boards. And
Absolutely.
You know, and, like, you know, deadlines come and, you know, you have to produce. And so I think that we need to see more in the way of not just, like, how security people talk to, you know, the security vendors like us talk to security departments in customers, but how we talk to IT people, how we talk to developers, because, like I said, like, everyone is making an internet connected something, right? And I cannot imagine a future where we'll have less internet in our life, right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, maybe when we go back to Steam or whatever, but but even that will be very radio-y.
Yeah. Actually, one of my most fun pen test engagements was because of an IT guy we were working with.
Yeah.
It was a red on blue, so, you know, they were trying to do live responses to us. And I was actually on the blue team side at this point, and the red team guy kept messing with us. And so we got the brilliant idea by talking to one of the IT support guys from this organization. We asked him where the mouse drivers were on the Windows machine. And we were able to get access to the red team machine and wipe their mouse drivers so he could no longer use his mouse to attack us. It was great. I think we did the keyboard at the same time. It was, yep. Yeah. Then we took a nice coffee break while he tried to figure out exactly what was wrong with his machine. It was a good time.
My go-to war story is, and it'll be super quick.
That's okay.
No. Is I was red team. And
somebody wipe your keyboard driver.
And like, suddenly my mouse wasn't working anymore. No. I was red team, and part of the engagement was to go to, like, it was a big sprawling campus, lots of buildings. It's a major hardware manufacturer that's listed on my resume, not hard to find out. and had to, you know, the task was drop a laptop on the local network that had a modem on the other side, so we could dial in and just have, like, persistent, right, on the thing. Well, on the way over to the other building, I was riding a motorcycle, and it was raining, and I dumped the bike. And so I'm now bloodied on the left side of my body. You know, jeans are all ripped up, and I've got this limp, but I'm really close. I'm like, look, I'm just going to drop the thing off, and then I'll go to the hospital.
Then medical emergency can commence.
It turns out, if you are obviously wounded, people open all kind of doors for you. So, like, all my plans of, you know, like, trying to be nice and social engineer my way past guards, because they didn't know who I was. It was a different building than I normally work in. Yeah, everybody was falling all over themselves, like, oh, wow, you look really hurt. Yeah, I got to go to the hospital. I got to drop this one thing off. Oh, can I get the door? Yeah, sure. You know, I just got to set up in, like, an empty cube. You have one. Oh, yeah, come here, use my cube.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm like, all right, cool. I'll just be, like, 10 minutes. It'll be fine, then I'm out. All right, do you need to call a hospital? No, I'm fine. I'll call somebody. It's fine. You know, as soon as they leave, boom, under the desk, plug the thing in, out.
That is dedication, Todd.
I was fine, by the way. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, good. How was your motorcycle?
Not too bad. I caught it with my boot, figuring my foot will heal faster than the bike. so it was fine. It was fine.
You're
and
talking.
I was wearing steel toe boots. So, like,
oh, okay.
I can't top that. I'm sorry.
No, invest in Halloween makeup. I mean, it's all cheap right now, right? It's like the day after, 2 days after Halloween. So, you know, bloody yourself up and walk into any building you like.
Sounds good. All right. Well, it's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's I had never thought of that.
And that's kind of the thing, right? This is the weakness of human hacking, right? Is that people want to be helpful. In the general, they want to be helpful. So, and that's why we always talk about, like, don't like let people tailgate behind him. It's really uncomfortable unless and until you have like a fun, like you can make it fun and you can gamify it and you can just have the corporate culture of like, no, dude, you have to have your badge, right? You have to have your badge. And if you don't have your badge, then you got to talk to the guy over here with the badge.
with the metal badge. Yeah.
So how does the injury compared to walking around with a clipboard, because that always used to be.
Clipboards and hard hats work pretty well. Just like claiming that you're from IT tends to work pretty well. It's like, oh, I got to fix this one thing. So typically, being friendly, making eye contact, doing all the things, being needing help, or if that's not working, like there's tons of like techniques, right? You can appeal to authority. You could say like, look, I'm from the CEO's office, and we need to get this done right now. And no, I don't have time for all your sign-offs. Please let me in the data center.
So is there anything that doesn't work that used to work?
Things that don't work that used to work.
I mean, are people getting any smarter about defending?
I want to think that. I think response rates to kind of to like your basic phishing attacks. If you drill your constituency on phishing by like doing it right, and then again, like you can be playful about the shaming part of it, but actually shaming them, that will tend to like knock down like that response time the next time you do it. Once you get that culture going that like I would prefer not to get busted by my red team, like it does help some, but then you'll hit a wall, right? You're gonna hit a wall there. And so, because the attacker only needs to be right once, the defender has to be right all the time.
But if you can instill a culture where people feel informed and educated about what attackers do. I had one example. I worked at a previous company that was very into design and color palettes, and the spring palette. And we had talked a lot about setting up fake websites and how companies would try and set up one that looks similar to your bank, and they'll try and trick you. And I got a panic call at 9 p.m. one night from one of the ladies on our design team, and she had tried to go to an internal website and got a 504 error. And she called me panicked because it was using 2 seasons ago color palette. And she was pretty sure that they would have changed it. And she thinks that it was fake because it was an old color palette. And it was somebody had just not updated it. But like, that was a big win for me. I was like, hey, good catch. We will look into that right now.
Sure. And like, I mean, because you have to treat like as an organization, to some extent, everyone is on your security team, right? You do have to farm that out. And so there is that trust. You need the people to trust you to that point where they feel like they can report things, that they can notice things. It is hard. Like, we do training on that, at Rabbit7. We offer that with, basically everybody up and down your organization. And get that going, because, like, if you can't take it too far, right? Like, if someone... If all of your employees are like living in mortal fear of the red team, they won't help the red team ever, like when they actually need help. So,
like, no, I am not holding that door. That's a fake injury, Todd.
No, I need to get
off. Okay, so going back to serious stuff.
Okay.
This is all serious.
It is all serious, but some of it's more serious.
Yes.
Sure. So, or some of it we don't laugh as much as mm-hmm. others. So, okay, vulnerability disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
I keep coming back, like, the story isn't the vulnerability so much as how the disclosure went. Like, we had responsible disclosure for a while, and then in 2010, Microsoft came up with coordinated disclosure, which they like to talk about, but nobody else... or a lot of people still seem to talk about responsible disclosure. Is there any movement towards figuring out a better way to go forward between the researchers and the companies that are making the software? And how do we do it, in a way that is fair for everybody, for the users, for the vendors, and for the researchers?
Well, I do think, like, not even so much the story of, like, how the disclosure went is the story. But how the patching is going, like where are the mitigations? Like, what's your short-term mitigation? What's your patch schedule? That's a problem we run into a lot. where I don't, you know, I'm not going to blame anybody for shipping bugs. Like, I have written software, I write plenty of bugs. Some of these bugs are going to be security issues. This is how we develop software today. Like, and like, if your strategy is, well, just don't ship bugs, like, you may as well say, like, your strategy is, like, first change human behavior. And that's not going to work, I promise you. I handle a lot of the vulnerability disclosure at Rapid, basically all the vulnerability, outbound vulnerability disclosure at Rapid7. And I used to get a lot more either silence, or when I would tell someone about a vulnerability, or angry letters on lawyer letterhead. I get far fewer of those today, and it's maybe totally anecdotal, but I rarely run in. I don't think I've run into that this year at all. So I am very happy with, like, where things are going. I think companies, you know, even small Kickstarter projects to Johnson & Johnson, like, are across the board, like, just kind of raising the bar of how we deal with security researchers, where they come knock in and tell you about a bug. It's gotten a lot more normalized. I think a lot of that is due to the bug bounties that have propped up. You know, you can have opinions on, like, the efficacy of bug bounties, but they're, at the very minimum, they're setting up an environment where it's okay to talk about this. You know, we live in a culture of see something, say something. And for a long time, that did not apply to the internet. If you saw something and said something, you would get an angry lawyer after you.
And I think we're seeing a lot more situations as well where the vulnerability disclosure is, like the example you gave there, it isn't that somebody found it, it's that somebody saw an attack. They saw somebody else exploiting it and were able to understand what had happened and report that. And I think those are critical situations where we need to have very good coordinated disclosure as well, because there is a definite threat from those vulnerabilities. And, you know, the faster you say the patching, let's get the patches out there. What are the hot fixes we can do in the meantime? What are the things to be watching for while you're trying to go through this process of an out-of-band patch or an expedited patching schedule, because there is a significant threat associated with that vulnerability? And I think a lot more people are starting to look to do that type of research as well.
Yep.
So we're going to start seeing that situation more.
So how about bug bounties? What do you think about that, or what should we know about those, or how are they working?
You know, I'm conflicted. You know, bug bounties are often set up with, here are these things that are in scope and these things that aren't, right? So that's kind of the first strike against, because the bad guys don't care about the things that are in and out of scope, right? If I'm an attacker and I'm targeting, you know, some company for some reason, you know, I'm going to sidestep everything that you think you care about, right? Like, I'm going to go after your home router, the CFO. You know, that's going to be a softer target. It's going to give me tons and tons of access to, like, your internal workings, and I guarantee the CFO's home router is not in scope for any bug bounty on Earth. And so there, on the other hand, you know, people should get paid for what they do. There are bug bounties set up now that don't give money. They give, you know, props and kudos and t-shirts, which I think is totally, which may be as effective or more effective than just straight paying for what comes down to volunteer ad hoc QA work. I think there are a lot of interesting ways to do it. I think it's evolving and shifting rapidly. The fact that we have two or three, like, real name brand companies in this space tells me that there's going to be, you know, there's a lot to come, right? And I at one point was very solidly against bug bounties, and it happened to coincide in a time when I was working on an open source exploitation development framework that required free information. Turns out, you know, Metasploit has, we've never paid for bugs for Metasploit, I don't think ever. You know, no, I cannot think of a single instance in the 16 years of Metasploit that we've ever done that. But it's real interesting how things are evolving now.
Yeah, I think it's a good avenue. I have a hard time. I know a lot of people talk about, well, you can get more money selling it on the black market than doing a bug bounty, but, like, Todd and I can go rob a bank right now and make a lot more money, and we still show up to work every day. Right. So I'm hoping that is a deterrent for some people, and that there are a lot of people who are still, you know, are interested and they feel compelled to find things like this. And I think it's really good for them to have a way to communicate that.
And if an organization has a bug bounty set up, like, this is a really strong signal that they are very mature, right? They have taken, you know, they've gone through all the heartache. They've talked to their legal teams.
They've talked to Todd.
They've probably talked to me. And that's why they now have one. And I think it's a really strong signal that company is taking security seriously on their development side, on their deployment side. They have a patching system. So, like, these are all, like, if I were to buy an IoT thing, right, and my two choices were from a company that had a bug bounty and one that didn't, I mean, I'm going to go for the bug bounty company every single time, because I know that they take it seriously, and I know that, like, on the day that they have bugs, which will come, there will be reasonable mitigation, they'll, you know, have a good story to tell, they'll have patches eventually, or at least something, right? They will acknowledge their flaws just like everyone else already has flaws, right? So
question, you say, if you had a choice between a thing from an IoT company that has a bug bounty versus not, what kind of, or are there manufacturers that you know of that are selling IoT things that have bug bounties right now?
Yeah. Yes. As far as I know, I'm trying to think of, like, I know that, like, Philips and Johnson & Johnson, both of which make medical devices, which when they go bad, people die. they are on the forefront of at least having, like, a strong disclosure kind of relationship with researchers. I don't believe they offer... Philips, I think, does offer a bug bounty. I'm not sure. You know, both of them, though, have, you know, they have dedicated aliases for security. They do all the right things, right, when it comes to disclosure. You know, there's... I know HackerOne has a database that's all, like, community-driven, where you can look them up. BugCrowd, I believe, has something that you can always look them up on any one of them, right? So, like, and that's kind of my first stop. Well, I have two stops, right? I want to see if they have a bug bounty, and I want to see if there's ever been, like, vulnerabilities disclosed on their products. A product that's never had a vulnerability disclosed is super fishy, because I know that they're in there. you know, ones that have had gone through the disclosure process, I know that they've at least someone has looked at it in the past, and they've already been through this whole process, right? So that's kind of like a mark. It's a high water mark, at least for them. Embrace your bugs. You know, like, that's the message I want to tell everyone, of just own them and fix them, and know that everyone else has bugs too, because that's how we do software. Like, when you are deploying software today, you set up all your feature requirements, you set up all your features, all your requirements, all your deadlines, and then you ship something that hits 30% of that, and you call it good, and you'll just fix it later. And that's how we do it, and that's fine. That's kind of...
I'm getting the feeling we should write, like, a children's book. Everyone has bugs.
Right.
Start teaching them young. Okay.
Well, so along those lines, earlier this year I talked to Paul Vixie about whatever the latest vulnerability du jour with, whether it was GhostScript or ShellShock or whatever. But we were talking about it. He pointed at this to the recorder. He said, you know, you're probably vulnerable on that device. I don't think so, but it's possible.
Sure.
I mean, so granted, there's what do you do, or is there a solution for? We've got all these millions or billions or hundreds of millions of things that are out there with these bad flaws in them. Is there anything? Is there any solution, or are there any approaches that we can take that mitigate the threat without actually going through and saying, this is bad, throw it in the garbage?
So I think taking a threat-based approach, I don't want to ever say, like, hey, cool, you know, you can monitor for threats so you don't have to fix things, because eventually the threats and the attackers will find a way around your mitigations and your preventions. But, like, we're seeing examples where, you know, most people are on a 30-day patch cycle. So if a new patch comes out for vulnerability, there, you can reasonably assume if everything's on track, 30 days, they'll be good. But we're seeing these rolled into exploit kits like 2-3 days later. So there's a huge delta there between when it's being exploited and when we can reasonably expect someone to patch for it. And in those situations, if you understand and you know, like, who is using it, how is it being used, and what signs can I look for, what artifacts or what will tell me that somebody is trying to exploit this, you can put in like some temporary mitigations and temporary blocks and preventions to stop that, but you still want to patch it. I think there are some examples where that might work, but again, attackers are creative. They're going to realize what we're doing, and they're going to find a way around it, so it's not a permanent solution ever.
As a consumer of IoT things, dang it, that's like ATM machines. bad talk. As a consumer of IoT, you know, I think a lot of it is just being mindful of the capabilities. So one, being mindful of it, of like where your devices are. I know eventually we're all going to lose track because we'll just all be made of Computronium and everything will be a thing on the internet. But secondly, don't ever trust the defaults. I mean, that's kind of the big takeaway of Mirai, right? Is that default security is not security. You know, until we get to a place where it's culturally normal to always have like random passwords on first boot, and it doesn't actually work until you click through a thing. Ultimately, this is a design issue. This is a UX issue. It's not strictly a security issue, but like when your UX prohibits you or discourages you from doing the right thing, then that's a that itself is a bug. It's a usability bug. You know, routers, home routers, very rarely will prompt you for things. Like you go buy one, you plug it in, and you're done. That's a recipe for disaster. So I would much rather people take that 5 minutes when they first get the thing and they unwrap it and they look at the quick start guide because no one reads the manual. And part of that setup process is, you know, unique passwords, default encryption, blah, 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 you know, all
did
this
I,
stuff.
Did I tell you my car story?
No.
This terrified me. This is from 2 weeks ago. I bought a new car. Super awesome. My car has Wi-Fi. The kids are very happy. Of course it does. As I was going through the process of setting up the Wi-Fi, they have you call to the person who's going to enable it. And they're like, okay, let's set you up. You know, you have to have your network name. Now, we recommend you use your last name. I'm like,
of course you do.
What? No, I'm more clever than that. So I was like, no, here's what I want to use for it. And she was like, oh, okay. And she's like, okay, now you should have a password to secure it. We recommend you use your phone number.
Okay.
And I was like, are you kidding me? You recommend, you're setting up right now people with their SSID of their last name and their password is their phone number on their car Wi-Fi. And she's like, yeah, it's easy for them to remember. I'm like, yeah. I think you might be introducing some problems here into this situation. And I couldn't believe that was the default. So a consumer right. Who's trying to do the right thing still going to be led astray.
It's not Linksys admin, right?
Like, that is
it,
true.
It is a step forward.
Okay, I will give you that.
It's a very small key space.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I don't know your last name and phone number, I can probably make pretty good guesses.
Yes.
So that's all good, but what I'm wondering about is everyone in this room, we know that when we get a router, or we know now anyway,
yeah.
When we get a router, to put up, you know, a strong password and all, you know, and we can sit there and download an image, you know.
We can do our own firmware.
Right.
Yeah.
But most consumers aren't doing that. So is there any way around? I mean...
Yeah, and we have to stop blaming the consumer for
yes.
this. Like that, I mean, that's just the line in the sand, right? Like this is not a consumer problem. It's the manufacturer's problem for sure. Like it is on the manufacturers of these devices to decide to strike a balance that recognizes the modern world, right? Like at one point, it was so super fine to be using Telnet and have a password of, you know,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Or autumn 2016, right? Like that's a fine password. please use that if you ever want to get owned. you know, and that there was a time where that was okay, right? Like I'm happy to admit it, and that time is in the past, and it will never come again. And so vendors have to take it upon themselves to solve this because you can't. It's only so long where you can keep blaming like user error, right? Because if the user error is they're doing all the defaults and therefore they're insecure, then that is a design error. Like I can't stress that enough.
Yeah.
But for things like, okay, you know, this doesn't have any firmware in it. Well, it's got.
Yeah.
I know. We wrote about that. Forget the. They had a
the
great
mouse
website.
Jacket.
Mouse jack. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sand jack. Or yeah, key jack.
Key jack. Yep.
Right.
All like, those. Yep.
All those things.
But, star jacking.
So the mitigation for this, if I remember correctly, was in this.
Mm-hmm.
But the mitigation for my router or my car, or your car, is. Or any of these other devices, let's say you've got a smart light bulb like mm-hmm. we mm-hmm. saw this morning.
Yeah.
It seems like if you don't want to blame the consumer, which is, you know, I don't, mm-hmm. I'm a consumer too.
Yeah.
I don't want
right.
to have to.
No one wants a head full of 500 passwords either,
yes.
by the way.
Yes.
Or even a notebook full of 500
right.
passwords. But yeah, like the DVR and the gaming consoles and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to deal with that, and some of those things will auto update, but mm-hmm. some of them won't. So, mm-hmm. are we just look? I mean, I mentioned talking to Paul Vixie in March, but what he said was, you know, those things are all going to get replaced, and when they get replaced, it'll be fixed, and or not.
Sure.
They, you know, like we still got people running Windows 95,
yep.
Windows 98,
yep.
Windows XP,
yeah.
but they're the minority. So.
I mean, we have a long tail legacy on the internet.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of legacy stuff. Like, that's why we still have
yeah.
millions of telnet servers on the internet.
Yeah. And it's not as easy as, you know, buying a new tape recorder. Some of these devices, especially when you talk about some of the, like, the manufacturing equipment, you know, they buy that intending to use it for 20 years because it is that expensive. They don't have it in their budget for another 5 years to get a new one.
No, yeah, it fails on both fronts.
Yeah.
A, it's expensive. B, you're never going to get rid of all the old stuff
yeah.
anyway. I think the it's crucial that there is at least some way to patch these things. Like the thing that makes the IoT interesting is the I part, right? It's on the internet.
Yeah.
If you're already on the internet, I'm positive you can use whatever channel that is to also distribute patches and do it in a secure way and make sure everything's signed and all that other stuff. But it is absolutely possible. You know, and so I know that your first gen is probably not gonna have that, but your second gen really ought to. If you're going to be willfully unable to get patches out and get updates out and firmware updates for everything, then you're asking for trouble because, like, we all know we ship bugs, and once you're in a position where you've shipped an unfixable bug, that's not
it's
a great position
here, yeah.
to be in.
So, okay, well, again, thank you both so much,
yep.
Rebecca Brown and Todd Beardsley of Rapid7. For talking to Search Security today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, my pleasure.